We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're back, we're dads on the air.
And welcome to Dads on the Air for this Tuesday, April the 19th, 2011. Can't believe it's almost Easter already. Here in the studio with me, we have Ian Purdy behind the controls.
Good morning, Greg, and good morning, listeners.
And also with us today, we have Ray Lenton.
From Dads in Distress. Yeah, welcome, Greg.
Great to have you with us, Ray.
Thank you.
And it's good for me to be back here. I haven't been out in the studio for quite some time.
You are, of course, Greg Andreessen. We better introduce you as well.
Thanks. I felt a bit awkward introducing myself. Yeah. Look, today we've got an interesting show. We mentioned probably a few weeks back that there's an interesting proposal in America. Warren Farrell, who we've had on this show many times in the past, who needs no introduction, but is the author of dozens of books, but the most famous is probably The Myth of Male Power. He's basically got together about over 30 scholars and academics and practitioners to lobby the Obama administration in America to establish a White House Council on Boys to Men. Now, the Obama, when he came to office, one of the very first things he did was all the feminists got in his ear and he signed a White House Council Commission on Women and Girls. And, you know,
Well, and he's surrounded by girls. I mean, he has his wife, of course, and he's got two daughters. So he doesn't have a son. There's no other males in his immediate family.
That's right. And a lot of his high up, advisors and staff are also women. So he's got women in his ear. And so, you know, it's great that he's looking after the women. That's weird. None of us would say that that's a bad thing. Women need support, but he's done nothing for boys and men. Surprise, surprise. So this is a proposal for a White House Council on Boys to Men. We're going to speak with two members of that council, Jack Kammer, and he's written a great book. It's been around a while now, but one of the earlier books I read on men's issues called If Men Have All the Power, How Come Women Make the Rules? And Other Radical Thoughts for Men Who Want More Fairness from Women. And also Tom Golden, who has written a number of books on grief and loss as it applies to men. So we'll be speaking to them from America. Until then, we've got a few news stories. Ian, I believe you've got an interesting story on one of the modern injuries to women.
Yes, well, there's an article in the Sunday Telegraph last Sunday. Under the heading Sky High Heels, a Party Killer, Brittany Stack has written, they're called killer heels for a reason. Sky High stilettos are now injuring more women than sports accidents. New South Wales ambulance paramedics report a rise in 000 calls by women suffering ankle fractures, dislocated knees, head injuries, and broken wrists caused by falling from their steepling shoes. So there you go. So the girls are, so apparently it's become more fashionable for higher heels. The girls want to be taller. They want to be looking the boys in the eye, if not looking down on us. And as a consequence, a lot of them are falling from greater heights and injuring themselves.
Do I need to throw mine away, Ian, or just be a bit more careful when I'm wearing them, mate?
Well, mate, I think you should stay in your high heels. I think, you know, a man of your stature needs to definitely get a bit more altitude.
You definitely need the altitude.
But we'll just watch out. The air does get a bit thinner up there. We don't want you getting dizzy. That's probably part of the problem, actually. They get themselves up there into the upper reaches of the atmosphere via these heels. There's not enough oxygen up there. They can't breathe properly. And they fall over, injuring themselves.
Yes, probably it's not wise to be on those killer heels while you're under the influence as well.
Well, yeah, that probably doesn't help. At parties as well.
Into it.
Yes. So, girls, a bit of advice from Dads on the Air. Throw the heels away. Get real. Get flat shoes. It's a lot safer. Come on. Guys, you know, a lot of guys are actually intimidated by tall women. If you want to intimidate us, well, it's not very intimidating lying on the floor with a broken wrist. That's all I've got to say. Ray, what have you got to throw in the heap?
This goes to the interview today with the myth of male power. The glass ceiling. It's back in the papers again. This is an article that was in Saturday's Telegraph. Have you ever felt the sting of a female boss? Women face an unexpected enemy in the battle to shatter the glass ceiling. Female bosses. They don't like other women climbing the ladder with them. Ian?
Well, that's... They should just all get stilettos and they won't have to climb any ladders, will they? You know, I mean, you can get more damaged falling off a ladder than you can off a pair of stilettos, I believe.
And look, Sydney women agree with them. So Sydney women yesterday agreed with findings from research by the University of Cincinnati. That's a good name for a town, Cincinnati. Isn't it?
It is.
It just rolls off the tongue.
It is.
Women managers can obstruct the career prospects of female employees while favouring men.
Well, there you go. Good old-fashioned sexism, and it's for a change, it's going our way. Instead of it all being, you know, man bashing,
because men wouldn't do that.
Well, but men, we wouldn't promote a woman ahead of a man. I don't think doesn't quite work that way, really, does it? In male culture,
and men wouldn't stop other men from getting up through that glass ceiling.
No.
Of course not.
Well, absolutely not. No.
It's not a dog-eat-dog world, mate.
No. There's no competition between men in the workplace at all.
Well, okay, now that's... Yeah. Okay, no. No, I'll draw the line there, guys.
That's right. We've all
got this a little bit sensible. That goes back to the point that... what's that British... Steve Moxon, that book.
The Woman Racket. Great book.
That there's much more competition in all arenas within the same sex, men competing against men... women competing against women, as this article shows, than there ever is in terms of, you know, women versus men or men versus women. Ian, I know you're a big fan of that book.
Absolutely. I interviewed Steve. It was a great interview, and he's a really smart guy and lots of insights, and we recommend it. Steve Moxon, The Woman Racket.
That's it. It's available for purchase on the Dads on the Air website, dadsontheair.net, if you want a copy. There's a few copies left and highly recommended.
And they've dubbed this the Queen Bee Syndrome. I like that. Another syndrome.
We need more syndromes.
In the record books.
Yeah. Right? I wonder if you can... There must be a point somewhere down in that story where it's not women's fault and where it's, you know, society or men are to blame for it all. I'm sure
driving them to it.
Yeah. I'm sure that must be there somewhere.
Well, it is. And she, I think the person involved goes on to say, it's not my philosophy. I'm only as good as the people around me. So it wasn't her fault, it was the people around us' fault.
Yeah. So. Well, I'm only good as you, as good as you guys by that philosophy, so lift your games, that's all I've got to say. lift your game.
And, I have sympathy for you, Ian.
And clinical psychologist Jo Lamble, is that the Jo Lamble that's on the Today Show on Channel 7?
Oh, not me, I don't watch that
She
stuff.
Says women are more prone to insecurity and jealousy, and why wouldn't they be? Women worry about losing positions of power, especially to another woman.
Yeah, sure men never worry about losing their job when they've got to provide for their wife and all their kids at home and pay off the mortgage. So they never worry. They're just chilling out. It's, I don't care if I lose my job.
Well, we got absolutely. It made. We've got it made, mate.
Got it made. We're in all the boardrooms.
Easy Street. That's where we live.
Yeah, we don't even have to run the country anymore.
No.
Well, once again, looks like we've got a lot of news about the fairer sex in today's show. There's news from the UK. There's been a large survey of British teachers, and it's basically found that there's rising levels of poor behaviour amongst girls in the classroom. Girls, they argue, are more likely to resort to cyberbullying, which is bullying over the internet, you know, Facebook, etc., mobile phones, which is worrying school leaders. So the survey reveals that half the teachers believed girls' behaviour had become worse during the past 2 years. One in five thought it was now more challenging than boys' behaviour. They said that girls are more sneakier than boys in the ways they misbehave. They're much more adept at using modern social media, such as Facebook, to bully their fellow pupils. They said girls spread rumours and fallouts last a long time, a 34-year-old teacher from Reading told researchers. Boys tend to sort it out fairly quickly. So basically what they're saying is, in modern-day classrooms in the UK, and I wouldn't be surprised if it's similar over here, boys are generally more physical, they may have a little bit of biffo, they'll sort it out, matter ended. Girls will bully in a very sneaky, backhanded way, which causes ongoing distress to other, mostly other girls. And, you know, we've heard stories of girls committing suicide because of bullying from other girls. It's really tragic.
Yeah,
so,
no, it's shocking.
And, of course, so this is really interesting. Maybe one of the unexpected fallouts of feminism. Who knows?
Well, and I don't think it's new. Social media brings a new face to it. But that layer of feminine behaviour is certainly not new in our society.
I agree. It's always been there. And
it's just they've got tools to exploit it, I guess.
Different tools, And there more effective tools. Yeah.
There was an interview with a professor from Sydney University just the other day. It was actually on TV. They filmed toddlers and very young boys and girls in a control environment, and there were girls playing together, three girls and three boys, and these young girls, they could hardly even speak, you know, they were very, very, very young, but these young girls were already, two of them would pair off and exclude the other girl. They're already exhibiting this sort of behaviour. It's you know, there may be something biological behind this. You know, who knows?
Absolutely.
I mean, Steve Moxon would probably agree with that.
There is. I mean, women's brains are wired differently. They have different aptitudes to men, and it manifests. And their disputes and conflicts in that way that you just described.
And yet we have respectful relationship programs being rolled out by the federal government here in Australia, and it's only targeting
boys and men against
girls.
Yeah, well, you know, we'll get around to sorting the girls out. We've got to sort the boys out first, perhaps.
I think so.
Yeah. Anyway, there's another spread, actually, in the Daily Telegraph last Friday. Students' Daily Drug Dealing Habits is the headline. Bruce McDougall has written, children as young as 9 have been caught possessing, supplying or dealing drugs at New South Wales schools, with some students hallucinating and collapsing under the influence. The youngest pupil found with drugs is a year 4 boy whose teacher seized dried cannabis leaves from his school bag. This is a shocking situation, ongoing situation, drugs in our schools. Children are taking drugs to school, which is a disgusting situation, and nobody would ever say there was anything good about that. I personally think that this is yet another symptom of the failure of the war on drugs, and that the way that we are dealing with drug issues is basically childish, that prohibition is a stupid idea. It's failed. It's romanticizing, it's glamorizing drugs. It's, you know, children taking drugs to school. I mean, they don't know what they're doing. In the same edition of the Telegraph, the editorial says that awkward but unavoidably necessary parental moment, the crucial first discussion about drugs, is becoming a feature in ever younger age brackets. Today's exclusive report in the Daily Telegraph indicates that the drug scourge is now spreading to children who are still several years away from becoming teenagers. The great worry is that such children are too young even to understand parental drug warnings or to appreciate their own mortality. At their vulnerable age, they are essentially the perfect victims of those who would manufacture and sell drugs. And I think the problem here is prohibition. You know, if we just took drugs out of the alley and away from the back room and all of the criminal activity, if we realize that people who take drugs are usually sick, that there is a reason why people become heroin addicts or whatever other addicts they want to become. It's usually because they have social problems, child abuse, sexual abuse. There's all sorts of issues which play into this. And criminalizing these victims is not the answer. The war on drugs has failed. I think we really need to relook at this whole issue. I think criminalization of drugs has failed. It's a failed experiment. And we need to basically bring these things into the light of day where we can examine them intelligently and rationally and deal with the victims as victims rather than locking them in jail and creating this huge black market where huge sums of money are regularly sequestered out of the economy and go into, you know, these underworld, you know, bikies and the like, all these drug syndicates who have more money than governments. You know, we've got the situation of the drug wars going on in Mexico at the moment where, you know, hundreds of people are being murdered. If drugs were made legal, if they were provided through chemists, you know, maybe a prescription, whatever. I'm not saying we should do what we've done with alcohol and advertise the damn things and, you know, present them as something glamorous and wonderful that everybody should get into. But if we approach the issue intelligently, we should certainly be able to get a better outcome than what we've got happening at the moment, with children in our school being caught with dangerous amounts of dangerous drugs. What do you think, guys?
Well, I think part of the problem, Ian, is that we don't put drug addicts in jail at the moment. We're caught between the devil and the deep blue sea. You know, that whole idea of criminalisation, we're caught in a nexus. We don't put drug addicts in jail. Matter of fact, if you have some form of psychotic event and you're addicted to drugs, you can get a disability pension, mate, which is about...
Well, they'll put you in a mental home and give you more drugs.
Well, exactly.
You still end up on drugs, but you don't get to choose which drugs you're on anymore.
And the state pays for it. They put you on a pension. You get about $180 a fortnight more than a person who's on the dole or a sole parent pensioner.
I think these are all symptoms of the overall problem, exactly. which is prohibition.
The lack of ability.
The problem is prohibition.
Exactly. The lack of the whole policy around prohibition, it falls short because we don't go all the way. We don't put them in jail. We don't put them anywhere. We just fund ridiculous things to keep people moving on, and we don't address the real issues that sit behind it. Your point about people who are sick, if you look at the drug industry, and we need to look at the whole drug culture in this country, we have had a serious drug culture for a long time. Look at the misuse of antibiotics.
Well, absolutely. And Australia was the biggest importer of pharmaceutical drugs up until about 1910 in the British Empire. So we have a history here in this country. People like to get out of it. But if you look at the big picture, the fact that the heroin industry is funding the Taliban. So we've declared this war on terrorism. But on the other hand, through our policies, through prohibition of drugs, we are funding it. We are funding the enemy.
The heroin industry in Afghanistan was the first industry the coalition rebuilt when they went in.
So there you go. So look, I rest my case. I think prohibition's failed. I'm not an advocate for, you know, everybody getting on drugs. That's not what we're talking about here at all. But
what about the parliament, mate?
Well,
what about if we send some pot down to the parliament? They could have a big love in down there.
Well, Mike can't. Well, Tony Abbott probably could do it. Well,
I reckon they could all do with a bit.
Spike Julia
might lighten them up a bit.
Time drink or something. You put a trip in her Chardonnay. You think
might lighten them
ecstasy
up a bit.
Ecstasy is what they need.
It might lighten. that'd be a big love in.
Put them all on ecstasy. That's what we say. I think we better go to a track here. I think we're digging a bit of a hole here, Ray. So look, we'll be back after this track with an interview. Greg, do you want to tell us a bit about this interview?
Yeah, look, as I said earlier, it's all about the new White House proposal for a White House Council on Boys to Men. We've got Jack Kammer and Tom Golden from the States joining us after the break.
Wasted kisses, red turns to blue. My kisses were wasted on you. Wasted hours and wasted pursuit. I was wasting my time picking the wrong fruit. The storm clouds opened, down came the rain. Everything I thought was precious went down the drain. Wasted promises, wasted lies, wasted kisses, wasted goodbyes. Wasted kisses, red turns to blue. My kisses were wasted on you. Wasted hours and wasted pursuit. I was wasting my time picking the wrong fruit. Here today, gone tomorrow. The only thing that's left of value is sorrow. Wasted kisses, a big wasted mess. We were wasted, I confess. Yeah, we were wasted, baby, wasted. Wasting all my time and all my kisses on you.
Wasted, baby, wasted. Wasting all my time and all my kisses on you. Yeah, we were wasted, baby, wasted. Wasting all my time and all my kisses on you. Yeah, we were wasted, baby, wasted. Wasting all my time and all my kisses on you. The story has ended. The plot has run out. The paper was wasted. Just writing it down. Everything wasted. Wasted for miles. Wasted lives. Wasted smiles. Wasted kisses. Red turns to blue. My kisses were wasted on you. Wasted hours and wasted pursuit. I was wasting my time picking the wrong fruit.
And we were wasted,
wasted kisses.
Wasted.
Red turns to blue. My kisses were wasted on you.
Wasted
pursuit. I was wasting my time picking the wrong fruit. Wasted kisses, red turns to blue. My kisses were wasted on you. Wasted hours, wasted pursuit. I was wasting my time picking the wrong fruit.
Wasted kisses, red turns to blue.
My kisses were wasted on you.
Grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child. Dad's in Distress, 1300 853 437.
We're back with Dad's on the Air.
Welcome back to Dad's on the Air. Today we have with us from America two guests who are part of the recently released proposal for a White House Council on Boys to Men. Now, we've heard over the years many White House councils and on women and girls, and these seem to have been widespread for many decades. But this is a very exciting initiative. It's the first time that we've heard such a proposal for a White House Council on Boys to Men. So, with us via Skype from the US, we have Jack Kammer and Tom Golden. Now, Jack. He returned to school at the age of 54 to earn master's degrees in social work and business administration, and he did so to document, highlight and take action on male gender issues and the social problems that arise when those issues are ignored and mishandled. He specialises in the race and gender effect on marginalised African American men and boys in urban settings. He's also the author of a great book that I read quite some time ago and found very full of wisdom and also full of humour, which is called If Men Have All the Power, How Come Women Make the Rules? And Other Radical Thoughts for Men Who Want More Fairness from Women. And another book called Goodwill Toward Men, Women Talk Candidly About the Balance of Power Between the Sexes. Also joining us, we have Tom Golden, and he's the author of two books about men's unique paths to healing. The first is called Swallowed by a Snake, The Gift of the Masculine Side of Healing, and the second is called A Man You Know Is Grieving, 12 Ideas for Helping Him Heal from Loss. Now, Tom's given workshops on this topic all around the world. His work's been featured in the New York Times, the Washington Post, on various different TV networks around America, and Tom also serves on the Maryland Commission for Men's Health, one of the few commissions for men or men's health in America, and he lives outside Washington, D.C. So, Tom, I might start off with you. Could you just fill our listeners in on How and when did this proposal come about for a White House Council on Boys to Men?
Well, Greg, it started back in 2009 when Warren Farrell got in touch with me and with the other members and said that he had this idea of pulling together a group of academicians and clinicians and researchers to try and create a document that would speak to the needs of boys and men. And so that's kind of how it got started. Warren pulled it together. It's better documented on the first page of the website, White House Boys to Men.
Do you want to just give us the exact URL just so our listeners can look that up?
Yes, it's whitehouseboys2men.com.
Okay, great. I know a lot of our listeners listen via the internet and they're probably jumping on that website right now. So, okay, so the front page of that gives a bit of a detail on the history.
Warren wrote a little ditty that talks about who he talked to at the White House and how it got started. Apparently, the White House Council for Women and Girls had initially asked Warren to be a consultant for them. And it was in his discussions with those folks that he thought, why not just do one for boys and men? So I think that's kind of the origin of it.
Okay, and where did it go from there? I imagine it can't have been an easy task getting together such a long list of, I guess, esteemed academics, researchers, practitioners from around America, and working together to come up with this proposal. How did that all come about?
Yeah, it was actually amazing to watch, and my hat is off to Warren Farrell for his ability to pull a very diverse group together. But a lot of the work was done on the phone. We would have conference calls where everyone would be on the line at the same time, and we'd be discussing things back and forth. So a good deal of the work was done there. Some of it was done on the web, in a web forum. Some of it was done via Google Docs. But a large part of the work, the actual work, was done via the phone.
So who were some of the other notable people on that who were involved in this process besides the two of you?
Well, let's see. Some names that might be recognizable down under, as we say here, would be perhaps you know the name Lionel Tiger, who wrote the is his book The Decline of Men, Tom?
Yeah, Decline of Males, I think.
Decline of Males. He's a professor, an esteemed professor at, I think, is it Rutgers, Tom? At a university in the U.S. He's pretty well known. Of course, Warren Farrell is the person who's heading up this effort, and people who are interested in men's issues know his pioneering work and leadership and his many great books. He also invited John Gray to join us. He participated a bit. I don't know what his participation is now. He's most notable for the book Men Are from Mars, Women Are from Venus.
That was a real bestseller over here as well in America. So I think a lot of people must be familiar with his work.
Yes. William Pollack, who wrote, was his book Real Boys, Tom?
Yes.
Michael Thompson, who with Dan Kindland wrote Raising Cain, a terrific book, is part of our group. It's quite a group. One of the leaders, along with Warren, the person who has been most instrumental with Warren, is Willie Iles, who is a high official with the Boy Scouts of America. And his main job with the Boy Scouts is government relations, and so he really knows his way around Washington. And he and Warren made lots of visits to organizations in D.C. whose support we are soliciting.
Great. It's great to know that there's people in D.C. who can hopefully make this proposal, help this proposal take off on the ground. Yeah. And, of course, there were some women involved, not just men on this committee. I note that Judith Kleinfeld, who directs the Boys Project, who we've had on this program in the past, was involved. And, of course, who could forget Christina Hoff Summers, who we've also had in this program, who's written a lot on gender issues and debunked a lot of the myths about that feminism's brought up. So it's really good to see such a great group of people come together.
Speaking of women, Greg, one other person I'd like to mention is...
Sure.
I can't think of her name right now, Tom. Maybe you know, but she is an official with the Girl Scouts, and she's been very supportive.
Tamara Woodbury.
Here we go.
Here on the CEO of the Girl Scouts. That's fantastic, and obviously, and I guess that brings up the point that this is not a competitive thing. I guess this is really coming from both genders, this need to say, let's look after the lives of and the transitions of boys and girls as they move into healthy adulthood, and let's not look at just one side of the equation, but let's look at everyone. It's not a men's rights push, but a push for balance and equity and fairness for both sexes. Would I be right in saying that?
Oh, yeah. You know, I think Warren puts it best when he says, with boys and girls, if either one is disadvantaged, then both lose. And I think that is kind of a theme that we've been working with, is we got to look at what's really happening now, and if either one is disadvantaged, we got to do something or both lose. And right now, it's the boys.
That's absolutely right. And it's also the case here in Australia that... and probably across the Western world, it's not unique to the States, this boy crisis, where in Australia here we have currently, in terms of Australian university graduates, or undergraduate degrees, there's 50% more women than men every year are graduating from our universities. That's astonishing, and no one seems to even raise that issue. I don't think I've seen that figure mentioned once in any media coverage in Australia, and this is sort of accepted as if, well, you go girls, isn't it great that the girls are ahead? But but when you then look at the rising rates of male unemployment and all the other areas of social disadvantage that this under-education leads to, you know, I think that you go girl attitude, you know, soon fades away, and we really need to treat this as a very serious issue. Do you want to just run through, there are five different components of this proposal. Maybe Jack, do you want to start talking initially about the first one, which is the education of our sons?
Yes, I'll be happy to talk a bit about that. That is not the work group that I participated in, so Tom, please feel free to jump in and fill in any gaps that I might leave. The question of education is very much as you outlined it, that girls seem to be doing quite well educationally. There is a lot of attention paid to those ways in which girls suffer a gap in math and science. I'm very concerned about that. That's fine. I'm glad that we're concerned about that. But the gap that girls suffer in math and science is rather small compared to the gap that boys suffer in reading and literacy. And there is very little attention paid to that. And reading is fundamental to learning in just about any subject. And if boys are not interested in reading, or if they perceive reading as being nerdy or sissy or for girls or something that they aren't invited to do because of the reading material that is selected that doesn't reflect their interests, then that's setting boys up for failure.
And I guess not just failure in the educational system, but in the workplace and across their lives generally, if they're not developing those literacy skills, that'll affect them in all areas of their lives.
Yes. I suppose we should also mention that there are lots of theories about what is going on with boys. One of our members is Dr. Leonard Sachs. He is very much a believer in the importance of single-sex education. He has also written a book in which he talks about the effect of estrogens. Correct me if I'm wrong, Tom, but I think he talks about estrogens or other hormones and chemicals in the environment that might be sapping boys' vigor and vitality, their energy. That's another theory. Michael Gurian is another person whom your listeners might recognize the name of, and he talks much about differences in learning styles between boys and girls, and I believe he also talks about differences physiologically in male and female brains.
Yes.
Now, you know, some of these things are controversial, it's probably a multifactorial problem that we're facing, so God bless Warren for bringing together multi-factors.
Right, and, you know, while the solutions to the education crisis in terms of boys may be difficult and complex, the poor outcomes are very clear to see, and it's not fair to, I guess, stick our heads in the sand and say it's all too hard.
Right.
It's great to see that there's such a great group of men and women actually tackling this issue, you know, I guess we have to test some of these hypotheses and see what it is that works in terms of improving education for boys.
Yes.
Now, the second component, Jack, I might just say, which was the main group that you were involved in working with?
I worked on men and work.
Okay. Do you want to talk a little bit about that issue?
Yeah. Tell me, first of all, did we keep men and work as the title for that heading?
From the website, I've got the future of work and
there you go.
Boys
okay.
and men at work. Yeah.
So okay. Yeah. That was the new wording we adopted. Well, first let me mention what my particular input into that section was, and then I'll try to talk a bit more about what the group as a whole talked about. My, I'd like to think of it as a contribution to the section is that. We need to provide for men and boys the same range of opportunities that we have provided for women and girls to do work, to contribute to their families, their communities, and to their own sense of happiness and fulfillment. I think that's a big problem that men and boys face, that over the past 50 or 60 years, we've done a good job as a society of opening up options for girls and women. They're no longer expected to stay home. They're no longer expected to focus on domestic things. They're allowed to do whatever they want to do, and I think it's probably rather demoralizing to boys to see that they really don't have those kinds of options, that it's very much about work, 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 money, 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 get that job. And if you aren't making big bucks, then at some level, you as a man are a failure. So I suggested that we include in that section ideas about opening up the definition of what constructive and respectable work for men and boys is in the first place. And then we also talked about the fact that blue-collar manufacturing jobs, which in the past, at least in America, I imagine in other parts of the developed world, provided good, high-paying, secure, steady, noble work for men with only high school, maybe even not even a high school education. Those jobs have pretty much disappeared from the United States, not entirely, of course, but cities that once were able to support a huge middle class of working people without great educations, those cities are struggling. And the men in those cities are struggling, and the families in those cities are struggling. And I'm in Baltimore, and Baltimore is one of them. So the discussion around that topic centered on the need to prepare men, to encourage men, to invite men into the burgeoning sectors of developing economies, which include many service careers, medicine being, I think, chief among them. And if, you know, if men think that doing customer service or patient service or hospitality service is, you know, something that is girly, well, then, you know, they're not going to be interested in taking those jobs, and employers might not be interested in hiring them. So it's very much about helping men make a transition from a blue-collar manufacturing economy into a more knowledge-based and service-oriented economy.
And was one of the issues that you discussed the lack of, I don't know if America's the same as Australia in this regard, but the lack of and decline of male teachers in our schools. Certainly in Australia, if you look at the graphs across the last couple of decades, the number of male teachers has been plummeting, and as you go into the younger age groups, so into primary school and into, of course, early childhood education, kindergarten, they're at record lows, and you're lucky to find, you know, one school in your city with a male teacher. Is that
yes.
an issue in America and something that you looked at?
Yes, it is. And there you point out how those two topics in our proposal very much overlap, because we wish to open up teaching as a field that men are explicitly invited into and feel is a noble and a respectable calling for them. And at the same time, this idea of men as teachers certainly affects the performance of boys as students. I shouldn't say certainly, but to my way of thinking, it almost certainly does.
Not to mention helping girl students as well, I think.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. There's an organization in the U.S., and it's got a website, so it's global. It's called menteach.org that is doing really good work on that topic. I think I'm a social worker, and I think that the same thing needs to be done for social workers. Tom's a social worker, and Tom and I have worked on trying to figure out ways to get more men involved in social work. I just had a meeting 2 days ago in D.C. with some people at a think tank, and we talked about the need to get more men in social work. And, of course, they said what everybody says, well, we need to raise the salaries of social workers so that men will be attracted to it. And I said, yeah, that's true. It would be good to raise the salaries of social workers. But, you know, we also need to ask, why do women feel free to take jobs that fulfill them emotionally and psychologically, even though the jobs don't pay a lot of money, but men don't feel as free? Why is that? We need to work on that as well.
Go on, Tom.
No, I was just agreeing 100%. And thinking back to the men teaching, I know a lot of little elementary school boys and some girls, in fact, who just would love to have a male teacher. You know, they tell me there's this one male teacher in their school and they really want him next year. Oh, can I please have the male teacher? It's like a drought. People are hungry for it. And we're just not providing it. It's a very female-oriented environment that is not so boy-friendly.
Absolutely. Well, we might take a short break now and take a music track, and we'll be back in a moment with more from Jack Kammer and Tom Golden, who have been working on the proposal for a White House Council on Boys to Men. We'll be back in a moment.
Baby,
grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you were ever there anyway.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1-300-853-437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
Okay, welcome back to Dads on the Air. We're talking to two members of the proposal for a White House Council on Boys to Men, Jack Kammer and Tom Golden from the States. And Tom, do you want to let our listeners know which was the particular area of the proposal which you worked upon?
Because I was on the health, the men's and boys' health work group.
Okay, so the emotional health of our sons, or is actually, it, or no, the, no, the crisis health. Of boys and men's physical health. Okay. Do you want to tell listeners a little bit about that issue?
Well, of course, I think it's a huge issue for men and boys, but the best way to describe, I think, what we did is to look at the very first quote on the proposal for the physical health section, and it reads, "Being male is now the single largest demographic factor for early death. If you could make male mortality rates the same as female rates, you'd do more good than curing cancer." Wow. And that's a quote from Randolph Ness, a professor of psychology at the University of Michigan. It's huge. I mean, just the whole health thing is huge. You know, men die earlier from almost every leading cause of death. The one that they don't die earlier from is Alzheimer's. And by that time, all the men are dead.
Right, they don't reach that age where Alzheimer's actually kicks in.
indeed, they're not there to be the leader, and so women lead in that respect. But I mean, the whole men's health thing is mind-blowingly glaring, and like other men's issues, it tends to be ignored.
So there's no men's health commissions in every state or federal commissions or, you know, to deal with this issue?
You know, there's a couple. Like the Maryland Men's Health Commission is one of maybe, I think, four or five in the country. But, you know, if you look at what's out there for women and girls, we have, I think it's six national commissions for women's health and zero for men. I mean, it's just mind-boggling. Because if you look at the stats, if you look at the research, it's very clear that men and boys are in trouble.
I remember when I was at university studying public health. I raised this with my professors. It just struck me as so amusing that whenever, you know, every single lecture we'd be going through all of these public health statistics, and always there was this glaring, you know, elephant in the room that men's health was so much poorer than women's health across the spectrum. And then when it came to doing a topic for a week on gendered health, it was about women's health.
And
this was only, you know, 4 or 5 years ago at a major Australian university. And I said to them, look, what, you know, why is it that when we're being fed these glaring statistics throughout the year, that suddenly when it comes to gender, we're only looking at women? And they muttered something about, oh, well, you know, it's men have had it good for so long, and this sort of feminist rhetoric about, you know, well, we always used to look at men's health, and it's about time we're now, you know. And I think that was the beginning of the end, and I actually left that course. But it sounds like things are fairly similar in the States. What are some of the solutions to this issue that you see, Tom?
To the health issue?
Yeah, I know it's a huge one, but what could we start with?
You could talk specifics, but I think more important is the issue you were just talking about, and that is how people tend to absolutely ignore the needs of men, but focus on the needs of women. And if you could change that, I think you would change a lot of the issues that we're talking about today. And, you know, I think that is a really important conversation to have. Why is it that we're like this? Why is it that we automatically think of women's needs, but we tend to ignore men's? And I think that a lot of it is built in to being a man and a woman. And some of it is built in biologically. Some of it is built in through our socialization. But, you know, the fact is men are not supposed to be dependent. You know, and if you are dependent as a man, you're seen as less than a man. There's a great quote on this by a guy named Peter Maron, who wrote an article about homelessness. But I think the quote applies to men in general, and it applies to everything we're talking about tonight. And it goes like this. To put it simply, men are neither supposed nor allowed to be dependent. They're expected to take care of others and themselves. And when they cannot or will not do it, then the assumption at the heart of the culture is that they are somehow less than men and therefore unworthy of help. An irony asserts itself. By being in need of help, men forfeit the right to it. And to me, that quote kind of puts it all together.
And yet, when we look at the socialization and social norms around being female, the society is almost set up, I guess.
Yes.
To respond to women's calls for help.
Yes, and I think that.
And you're no less of a woman if you ask for help, right?
Yes, women are allowed to be dependent. In fact, they're encouraged to be dependent, and men will compete to serve them. But we don't have a third sex who's competing to take care of men.
You know what I mean? And do you think that this all comes down to this deep, almost biological or gut instinct that we all have as men and women when, for example, if someone said, we're going to... change our military structure and we're going to put all women on the front lines. All of us have this deep gut horror that, you know, and it's no different really, sort of academically, from having all men on the front lines, especially with today's technology and military technology. But there's something about that really strikes us as wrong, even if rationally we may think, well, that's kind of... And How do we get over that if that's such a deeply ingrained instinct in us to protect and look after females and not to do the same for males? Is it a matter of going to the education system and really, you know?
I think the first thing is just to raise some consciousness, because
have this discussion.
Yes, people are unaware of this automatic thing they do. And the more people start to become aware of it, I mean, the more things can possibly change. Until we change that underlying assumption, though, I don't think things are going to change so much. Because people don't see a need for counsel for men and boys. You know, they don't see a need for focusing on men's health.
Is another issue, and I might throw this to you, Jack, looking at these deep-seated cultural issues that are behind, I guess, all of these components in the proposal, is another issue the widespread belief, I guess, for the last 30 or 40 years that, oh, but men still have all the power. Let's look at government, it's mainly men. Let's look at the heads of corporations, they're mainly men. And somehow that translates into thinking, well, all boys and men are doing pretty well. Do you think that's an issue?
Well, I think that underlies the great reluctance that our society has to paying attention to the problems of boys and men in any category, health included, but virtually any other category. And the idea that men have all the power is the idea that I try to skewer in the book, If Men Have All the Power, How Come Women Make the Rules? And one of the things that is important to say is that certainly men don't have all the power in any category, but we can acknowledge that men as a group have more power than women in some categories. Economic power, perhaps, government power, perhaps. But we also need to take a look at the arenas of life in which women have significant power. And that's much less familiar terrain for us to discuss. But there are certainly ways in which women have an advantage in terms of influence and control. And one of the entry points for coming to that understanding is to point out that men have an advantage in the types of power where we have been raised to believe we are superior in the ways in which having that kind of power requires.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're stronger, we can do math, blah, 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 blah. So, okay, so from our being raised to feel superior, we can see a connection to the ways in which we have more power. So a good entry point into seeing how women have power and control in certain important aspects of life is to step back and catalog all of the ways in which we as a culture believe that women are superior to men.
Okay.
Women are more loving. Women are more loving. They're more nurturing. They're more kind. They're more gentle. They're more patient. They're more sweet. They have intuition. They understand people better than men do. So if all of that is true, to what important spheres of life will we entrust women to be in charge? And, you know, it doesn't involve dollars. It doesn't involve moving armies. But it certainly involves very, very important and powerful and rewarding aspects of life.
By that, I guess you're leaning towards, the dominance of women in what we've just talked about, in the social sciences, in the so-called caring professions, in the education system, and all
not,
of that.
Not just in professions. Not just in professions.
Okay.
But your show is about fathers, right?
Right.
Okay, well, there it is.
So looking inside the home.
Well, there is a very strong culture of, or a very strong belief in maternal supremacy that operates pervasively in our culture.
Yeah, well, we have here in Australia, almost without exception, any service that is set up for parents is really set up for mothers when you look at it, and plus, there are many services that are explicitly set up for mothers. But and there's been a lot of work in this regard in terms of trying to shift those services to realize that, hey, dads are parents too. But it's,
you bet. And I have had a little bit of a conversation with a professor. I couldn't press it too hard because he still had the power to give me a grade. But there was a professor at my school of social work. Tom will know this. Tom, what do social workers call the field of looking at the health of parents and children? You familiar?
Mm-hmm.
Maternal and child health.
Mm, right. Same here.
And it's,
right.
And it's not just about maternal health during gestation. It's maternal health after the child is born. So I asked my professor, why is this called maternal? Why is it not called parental and child health? And I got probably the exact same murmuring that you got when you raised the question with your public health professors.
Well, I'm involved in a group in a dad's group here, and I'm very fortunate that, you know, 5 minutes drive from me there is this group of both expectant dads and new dads, and we get together every week, and that, you know, it's invaluable for us. But as far as I'm aware, it's the only such group in the entire city of 5 million people, and yet every in every suburb there are dozens of mothers' groups, and in fact, the hospital system is set up so that every mum, once she's given birth, is actually put into a mothers' group, and she may decide to stay or leave. And there's absolutely no parallel for new dads, and yet these dads are increasingly wanting to and being expected to take on a huge, much more than they previously historically did, role in terms of the hands-on day-to-day care of their kids, and yet there's absolutely no support or recognition for that whatsoever. As a new dad, I'm sorry, I don't mean to editorialize, but I'm pretty passionate about this. It's really a shocking indictment on our society's valuing of motherhood and fatherhood, I guess.
Yes, yes.
Well, I would suggest that what we saw 50 years ago, where men did their best, not all men, but many men, did their best to resist women's entry into previously male domains, namely government and the world of careers and paid work. The parallel to that is the resistance that fathers encounter when they try to enter as equals into the world that's previously been put under women's domain, which is the world of nurturance. There is a lot of wonderful stuff that comes through participation in that world, and it's not because women are bad or evil, but because they are human, that they want to keep it to themselves. The mistake that the women's movement made, I think, 50 or 60 years ago, was to suggest that men's desire to keep the world of work and government and politics to themselves was because we were male chauvinist pigs and evil and Neanderthalish. No, it's because this is what we were told was our domain, and you know, what are we getting in return for giving it up? And I think that points to really a fundamental problem, which is that the whole gender equality equation was really unidirectional, and we need to renegotiate. What do men get in return for what we give up?
Yes.
And we haven't yet gotten women to come to the table to say, yeah, you know, we've got some pretty sweet advantages on our side of the table. So in the interest of fairness and equity and health for all of us, yeah, we know we need to open up our doors too.
Mm. Well, look, this links probably quite well into component three of the proposal, which is what's missing when dad's missing, or that the crisis of fatherlessness in America and around the Western world. Is there anything more that either of you want to add in terms of, I guess, the social ills that come about when we have a generation of boys that are raised in single mother homes and possibly go through an education system where there's no males teaching in the classroom, except maybe the janitor and possibly the headmaster who doesn't get involved in the teaching.
I'd like to say a few things. Tom, do you want to?
No, you go ahead, Jeff.
Okay. I work in a jail. And I work in a jail in Baltimore City. Did you all ever see The Wire over there, the TV show The Wire?
Yeah, I think it did make it over here, yep.
Okay. I work in the jail where parts of The Wire were filmed or taped. And I see it's a men's jail. And I see the problem of fatherlessness every day. And I get a chance to talk with some of these fellows about the absence of fathers in their lives. And it's pretty devastating. But, you know, you don't have to be in jail to feel that way. I feel a lot of father hunger in my own life because my father was a typical 50s father, worked his buns off and came home cranky and grumpy. And I've had to fill in some gaps in my own psyche about things I wish my father had, you know, been around to teach me.
Mm.
When I am in the jail talking to my inmates, my detainees, I'm faced with what I call the hell of jail. And the hell of jail is that you never really know who you can trust and who you can't trust, because there's a lot of lying that goes on in jail. But there is one instance, one occasion that I often have with my inmates when I am quite confident that they are telling me the truth because they have no reason to lie to me, and that's right before they are released. You know, their paperwork is done, they're just mm-hmm. waiting for the final T's to be crossed and the I's to be dotted, and they're on their way. And we have some good heart-to-heart talks about who they want to be and how they got to be where they are. And you know, I don't think we need to talk too much about the damage that is caused by fatherlessness to young people, boys and girls. But an aspect of the problem of fatherlessness that I would like to bring a bit of attention to is that fatherhood is not just good for kids. It's good for men. It's good for the fathers. These men have such pain and such shame about being in jail when their kids are out there. And they know that these kids need them, and they know they want to do better because they know how much pain they felt when their fathers weren't around for them. And when they talk about their kids, and some of them actually wear big, gaudy pendants with pictures of their kids around their neck. Now, you know, you would think these are, you know, tough guys. But everybody in jail respects the need and the beauty and the power of fatherhood. So, you know, elevating fatherhood and giving it the support that it needs really could be one of the greatest anti-crime programs we could undertake. Fatherlessness, you know, creates fatherless children, and it also creates childless fathers. And childless fathers often have a lot of pain in them.
And not to mention the fact that the fatherlessness also leads to higher rates of teenage pregnancy and various ills, social ills for young girls and women as well. So
you bet,
you know,
you bet.
It's not like it's just helping boys. It's really right. Good for everyone.
You bet. Now, what you just said is correct, and we need to be mindful of the benefit that fathers provide to young girls. But if I may, I would like to tell a story that I often share with the men right before they're released.
Absolutely, please.
Okay. I tell them about an article from the magazine Nature. I think it was Nature, which is a pretty highly regarded science publication that talked about a game preserve in, I think it was South Africa, where human poachers came with their high-powered rifles and decimated the adult male elephant population because the tusks of these elephants is valuable on the market, on the black market. So with the adult male elephant population wiped out, the young male elephants went basically, in layman's terms, crazy. They went crazy. The scientific term, I think, is must, M-U-S-T-H, which I believe is characterized by a surge, not as a cause of the craziness, but as a result of the craziness, a surge in testosterone. These young, basically teenage elephants got rushed into the need to feel like they had to be adults, because in the absence of adult male elephants, everything was a threat to them. And so they attacked giraffes and zebras and rhinoceroses for no good reason. They basically went crazy. To solve the problem, the game preserve managers went to another part of the country, to another game preserve, rounded up a bunch of adult male elephants, bull elephants, brought them back to the section, to the game preserve, which was suffering a lack of adult male elephants, and turn these adult male elephants loose. Well, what do you think happened with the young male elephants? They went back to being teenagers. It was as if the adult male elephants came back and said, "We got this. We got this."
Right. Chill out, guys. We've got this.
We got this. Yeah. You're safe. Go be a teenager. You don't have to save the world. You're not the man of the house. Go be a teenager. And when I tell this story to the men in the prison, in the jail, about the value that they can have in their communities, whether they have a paid job or not, because as a practical matter, these guys aren't going to get great paid jobs. because there's a recession going on. They don't have great work skills. They don't have much of an education. They don't have much of a work history.
And they have a criminal record.
And they got a criminal record.
Right.
And so, you know, if we put all of their self-worth eggs in the basket of got to get a job, got to get a job, you know, we're basically creating an omelet. You know, the eggs are going to break. We need to expand these men's value proposition. And the proposition that you, just by virtue of being an adult male who has seen the ways, the mistakes of your earlier days, and who sees the same mistakes being made by what we call the knuckleheads in the jail, the 20 and 21 and 22-year-olds, you have value in your community whether you have a paid job or not. Do not let your entire psyche be dependent upon making money. Sure, we want you to have a job, but that's not going to come easy. And if we can give a man an expanded value proposition where he has a paid job surrounded by all kinds of other reinforcing value propositions, that job that might only pay him $8.50 an hour, which many guys would consider chump change because by itself it is, that $8.50 an hour job supported by all kinds of other value propositions, that's a pretty good piece of a portfolio. But we don't do that. It's all about get the job, get the job, get the job. And even worse, it's get the job so you can pay child support.
Okay. Mm.
Tom, did you want to join in there?
No, I think it's a great story, Jack.
Yeah.
It's a great story. It's so true. You know, our fathers are so important. And we're finding that the physical changes in fathers are much more than we ever thought. I don't know, Greg, if you know this or not, but they're finding now that the hormones of the father when the wife becomes pregnant change automatically, and his testosterone levels start going down because his wife is pregnant. They're not sure how he knows this is happening. I think they're thinking it has to do with smells, you know, but you know, the importance of fathers is huge. And Jack, I love the idea of men knowing that they are valued simply for being men.
Mm.
I mean, this is the message we just got to get across to people, you know, is that they have value. And Jack talks sometimes, and it just tickles me, you know, when he talks about this. He says, we've spent 50 years with pep rallies for women and girls. Go girls, go girls, go girls. But we've done almost nothing for men and boys. We really need to get out there and start saying, you know, it's good to be a man, and it's good to be a young man. And start valuing maleness. Because right now we're not. We're hiding. And, you know, we need to come out front and center and say, I'm proud of being a man. Men are good.
And look, not only do we not have those positive messages that men and boys have value inherently just because of their maleness, we actually still have, through the media and through through the academic world, we still have all of these messages about men are dangerous, men are bad, men are, you know, child abusers, men are rapists, men, you know, this leftover stuff from the last 30 or 40 years, which is still circulating in our society. So we have lots of negative along with no positive, and that is a recipe for disaster for, for all the men, but especially for young men. And that may lead us on to talk about the last component in the proposal, which is the emotional health of our sons. But first of all, we might just take a quick break and have another music track. We're talking with Jack Kammer and Tom Golden from the United States about the proposal for a White House Council on Boys to Men, and we'll be back in a minute. So fine.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437, or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
Welcome back to Dads on the Air. We're talking with Jack Kammer and Tom Golden from America about the proposal for a White House Council on Boys to Men. Just before the break, we talked about the last of the five components of this proposal, which is the emotional health of our sons, and that deals with issues such as the high rates of suicide for teenage boys compared to girls, depression, and also about the lack of mentoring programs and male rites of passage that guide boys and young men healthily from being a boy into being a man. Jack and Tom, would either of you like to speak on this particular point?
I'd be happy to, but Tom, you're probably better equipped. You want to go?
Well, go ahead, Jack.
Well, on this topic, we had, as I mentioned, the participation of a couple of boy psychologists, boy-friendly psychologists. Michael Thompson, who with Dan Kinlan wrote the book Raising Cain, which is really a wonderful book. And Michael Thompson also did a one-hour, I think it's a one-hour, might be a two-hour DVD presentation of the topics of his book, done by PBS, Public Broadcasting System. The DVD is available on the web if anybody wants to see it. It's really wonderful. It's a great book. Also, I mentioned, I think it's William Pollack who did, is it Real Boys?
Mm-hmm.
And both of these boy-friendly psychologists, I'm not sure if one of them is a psychiatrist or not. I'm not sure if Pollack is a psychiatrist or a psychologist, but they're both boy-friendly. They talk about straitjacket in which we put boys emotionally, or they talk about the male mask in which we that we require boys to hide behind. They talk about the boy code that boys feel the need to subscribe to, you know, never show any weakness. Some boys will feel the need to be the top dog because if they subscribe too much to the boy code, they either are the top dog or they're losers, you know, without space in their minds of, you know, we're all colleagues, we're all buddies, we're all friends here. And so, you know, if the world is a place of relentless competition, and if your world judges you either as being valuable or disposable, well, it's pretty terrifying to think that you might be the latter. And we don't really give boys an opportunity to talk about their insecurities and the ways in which they fear that they might be not everything they ought to be. And it can be terrifying, frightening. The boys feel the need to repress what's really going on in their lives. And, you know, being not true to who you really are and what's really going on in your life is a formula for emotional ill health.
And isolation, I guess, as well.
Yeah.
And I guess all of this comes through in the high rates of depression and suicide with, you know, in young men. And also, I guess, violence and criminality amongst young men as well. It's another thing that may come out of this this same issue, in that this need, this boy code that sort of makes them need to be the tough guy and the top dog may also... And I guess with the, and also the lack of mature, healthy male role models, and so that these boys seek role models amongst their peers, leads to this criminality, the gang violence and all that side of things.
Right. There's a saying that you often hear in the jail: hurt people hurt people. People who are hurt often seek to hurt others.
Yes.
And you see that a lot. I've even got a theory. I don't think it's testable. But I've got a theory that some of the baddest guys, some of the meanest guys are guys who, when they were young, were the most open and sweet and optimistic. And the life of being a young boy in a tough environment, who was sweet and open and optimistic, was so dangerous, so ugly, and they were so vulnerable, and their inner selves were so crushed and damaged that they adopted the idea that the only way for me to keep my sweetness from being smashed is to be a mean son of a bitch. And I think I see that a lot.
Yeah, because you know, I think a part of that, Jack, has to do with you know, the only acceptable emotion that men have to express oftentimes is anger. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, if men are sad in public unless they just won the Heisman Trophy, they're thought of as being less than. Mm-hmm. But anger is something that men have been able to use for centuries as a means to express themselves. And I see it all the time in my practice with men, is that oftentimes men will use anger as a means to get in touch with their hurt and their unhappiness.
Right.
So, you know, this plays along with the whole thing that we're realizing now, that when men are depressed, they're much less likely to be sad and forlorn. They're much more likely to be irritable and jerks, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, that is a sign for a man who's depressed, is when he starts acting out in a way that is irritable and nasty. You know, that is a sign of depression. Of course, what happens when most of us see that is we just go, oh, what a jackass. You know, we walk away. But we got to start learning that, oops, you know, this may very well be a sign that this guy's depressed.
I remember an incident at the pub a few years ago when there was another couple there, and they'd obviously just broken up, and this was causing a lot of distress, and the only way the guy could deal with it was really getting angry, and he stormed out of there and, you know, slammed the door, and everyone gathered around the young woman to support her. She's the poor one, and oh, this horrible angry man. And that poor man, who, you know, he wasn't angry at her, he was hurting, he was grieving, he was dealing with the loss of love, and yet because he'd acted out in the only way he knew that was socially acceptable, he was left wandering down the street alone with no one putting an arm around him to say, hey, mate, you know, do you want to have a chat about this, or do you need any help? So I think that's
over and over again. I've seen it over and over again.
Go ahead, John.
My practice, once they get angry, I mean really angry, I mean, you know, fists, red face, etc., suddenly that anger just turns right into tears. And the tears just flow out. But they don't do it unless they feel safe. Mm-hmm. You know, safety is the biggest piece of all that. But oftentimes it's the anger that will move men into a space where they are able to deal with that hurt.
Well, it's been a great pleasure talking with the both of you today. Do you know what the current status of this proposal is? We've covered a lot of ground in terms of the issues that it raises. Are you guys being optimistic or pessimistic in terms of this proposal actually getting some legs and being adopted by the government?
Always optimistic, Greg. Always.
That's good to hear. And Jack, are you as optimistic as Tom?
Well, I'm not sure how optimistic Tom is. I go back and forth. It's been 2 years since more than 2 years that we've been working on this, and you know, for all of the reasons we've talked about, it's not just, you know, the White House that we need to convince. The White House needs to look at the culture. You know, what's the culture going to think? What's the body politic going to think if it goes and creates this council for boys to men? Oh my God, what's that about? You know, it's a big step we're asking the White House to take. But
well, I guess in a sense, it's almost like a litmus test, isn't it, in terms of Is Western culture ready to say that they're prepared to to support males the way that they've been supporting females for the last, you know, 30 or 40 years. In the sense that we live in a democracy and the government isn't going to adopt any proposal that they think will get them voted out of office. It is a bit of a litmus test, I think.
Yes, I agree.
It brings to mind something that we've talked about during our conference calls. Tom, you might remember which president it was, but it was either Franklin Roosevelt or John F. Kennedy or some president who was approached by, I think it was some civil rights leaders, might have been Martin Luther King, who came and, I guess it wasn't Franklin Delano Roosevelt if it was Martin Luther King.
Yeah, but it was Kennedy.
It was Kennedy then. Kennedy was asked to advance an agenda, a civil rights agenda. And the story goes that he said, fine, go out and make me. Go out and make me. Line up the social forces, the political forces, so that I can do this. So that I won't have any choice but to do this. Right. We really don't have much political horsepower in the direction of moving the White House in the direction we'd like them to go. I mean, if they look around and see how many men are clamoring, how many women are clamoring for a White House counsel on boys to men, not many. So, you know, we're really asking for a leap of leadership here. You know, seeing what needs to be done, and it's pretty manifest that there is a place for this council. Now, you know, the president he's just announced his reelection campaign. So, you know, you get three people together anywhere, especially in Washington D.C., and you got politics. So it's a political question as well as a social sciences question. But it really, to me, is a question of leadership. And I hope the president and his people will say, yeah, we need to do this.
I hope so, too.
Yeah.
Well, all the best to the both of you and to the other 20 or 30 of you who are involved in the long, hard work of putting this proposal together. Please keep us updated on how things progress. I might just end up just asking both of you, do either of you have websites or that we can give to the listeners to if they want to find out a bit more about yourself and your work? Maybe, Tom, do you want to start off?
Sure. The men's work side of things, I have a website called menaregood.com.
Excellent.
And Jack, what's yours?
The website that I might invite people to take a look at is called believeinmen.com. It's the website for the Center for Men and Boys in Social Policy. I can quickly describe the organizational chart of the Center for Men and Boys in Social Policy. Can I describe the
yep,
organizational chart to you? It's a rectangle with the word Jack in it.
Okay. Excellent.
It's just me. It's just me, but on the website I put forth some ideas about how our social services and our policymakers could do a better job in understanding and analyzing and dealing with the problems of men and boys and the ways in which those social problems affect us all.
Great. So that's believeinmen.com.
Yes.
Well, Jack Kammer, Tom Golden, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on Dads on the Air today, and all the best in your work for the future.
It's been a great pleasure being on your show, Greg. Thank you very much.
Sure. Greg, thank you very much.
Cheers. All the best.
Good night.
Well, that's it for Dads on the Air for this week. You can download the show from the website, www.dadsontheair.net. Ray Lenton, Ian Purdy, Greg Andreessen signing off for another week. Ian, did you want to mention the Blokes Day?
Oh, look, we'll mention that next week. I don't think we've really got time. We'll be back next week.
Yep. Be kind to each other, folks.
Dad's on the air. We're here 'cause we care. We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're dads.